Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So on the second talk of this 2009 rains retreat at Bunyana Monastery, we have just chanted one of my favorite suttas, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta on non-self. The reason why it's one of my favorite suttas is not only because of how profound it is, but also the recognition that this was the sutta which created the first five arahats after the Lord Buddha. In the sutta we chanted a week before, the Dhammacakka Sutta, that created the first dream winner. But this was the one who created the first five enlightened beings after the Buddha. So it's a very powerful teaching. And I just, out of inspiration of chanting it, just wanted to talk and just to focus on how powerful it is. I do remember that when I did my 6 month retreat here in this monastery, with silence, not doing anything or talking to anybody or being with anybody, there was the one sutta which I was focusing on throughout the time, because I've got great inspiration and meaning from it. It's a very thorough teaching, because it creates a framework for one's own experience of life. Whatever one is experiencing, one sees that the most important part of this is those first sayings that if these five khandhas, you know, the things outside of you, your feelings, your pleasure and pain, perceptions, your thoughts and your will and your conscious experience, your vijnana, your consciousness, each one of these, if they really belong to you, if they really were yours, you'd be able to control them, to manipulate them, to make them follow your commands. But the Buddha said, because these things aren't yours, they don't belong to you, you find you just can't do that. And sitting in my seat as an abbot and talking to all the people who come at lunchtime or afterwards with all the difficulties and problems, you see that all the problems of human beings is always frustration. Frustration and hope. The frustration of looking at just how they haven't been able to control their life, how that life creates pain, suffering, disappointments, no matter how wise and how clever, no matter how much effort they put into things, they don't get any satisfaction, no peace, no happiness. And because of that, they think, that it's because that they're not clever enough, they're not smart enough, and they just try and control and manipulate even more. But the Buddha said that, look, so these things, it's their very nature to be out of control. If the things outside, if one's feelings, if one's perceptions, if one's thoughts and will, if one's consciousness really did belong to you, then sure that you could manipulate it. Even if it belonged to you a little bit, you could have some influence on it. But if you reflect upon your life so far, and if you are wise enough to contemplate the lives of others, the life is just a series of frustrations and ridiculous hopes for the future, that if I do something else, change the way of my lifestyle, work harder, work less, do this, do that, move here, move there, then somehow or other that I will be able to solve the problem of suffering and be able to have some peace and happiness and fulfillment in life. And again, I was saying, because of the role of an abbot, you listen to people all the time. You listen to people with their successes, you listen to people with their failures. You see them grow up in their life and see them just get married and then have their arguments and then go out and get drunk when it doesn't work, like one man today was telling me. and then going off and getting old and getting sick and dying. And you can see this all the time, and sometimes it looks so sad that, you know, like Silvana, just a young mother, you know, just going to die in the next couple of days of a horrendous cancer. And doesn't matter what we do, we're faced with this situation of this human body and this human mind, which is totally out of control. And if it really was yours, you would be able to control it. And the Buddha in his great teaching was saying, look, you are not the problem. It's not your inability. It's not the fact you're not trying hard enough. It's not the fact you're not wise enough. It's not the fact that, you know, you need to train more. He said, the whole thing is essentially impossible to control. That these things, they come and go according to their own nature. And basically all your efforts, all your controlling, all your manipulating, all your wriggling and writhing, he said, it's not going to do very much. Sure, it can lessen the suffering a little bit, but essentially it's going to just lead to more frustration and worry. And it was such a teaching as that, which not only taught me just the hopelessness of trying to manipulate the world. And sometimes I looked at my life as just even as a monk, trying really hard to do the very best and to make a good monastery. And even on things I thought I should be able to control, like buildings. Even the buildings which you tried to sort of, you thought at least I could control a brick and put it in the right place. But you all know the story of the brick wall and the two bad bricks. Even though I tried really hard to be perfect, it still didn't work out properly. And even though you tried to mend those mistakes, you know, whenever I look at all the buildings I've constructed in this monastery, it's very easy for me to see the mistakes there, because I know exactly where they are. And I'm sure Ajahn Bhumari knows all the mistakes in his work as well. Whatever you've done, there are so many mistakes, and you try your hardest to do it perfect, but it's impossible. I know when I was also a young monk, there was a little competition of the Western monks in Thailand to be the first one who recites the perfect Patimokkha without any mistakes at all. Yesterday Venerable Ozana did a very good job, but he still made one or two mistakes. And after a while I thought, what the heck am I doing that for, trying to sort of do a perfect Patimokkha? Because there's no way you can do that. Okay, some monks manage to achieve that, but so what? And they try so hard. And this is not what we're supposed to be doing as monks, trying to sort of make the perfect Patimokkha or the perfect monastery, because that just leads to so much frustration. And people live in the world who try and live the perfect life, have a nice partner in life, a nice little house. Just life isn't perfect. And the sooner we get to realize that, the sooner we understand that our job is not to try and manipulate and be more clever to get the way, to get what we want, but actually to let go of all this wanting business, let go of all this controlling business. In order to overcome desires and craving and wanting and controlling, one of the first things we need to see is the impossibility of achieving our goals. It's not the goals are not right, it's just that the world doesn't allow that to happen. Just the law of karma, just the way this world works, means that all of our striving and wanting and craving and thoughts and plans, they won't produce what we desire. As somebody said a long time ago, I remember this saying before I came to Australia, that desire is always unfaithful to its object. Desire promises you things, but never fulfills a bargain. When you want something, you feel that once you get that, you'll have some sort of happiness. That's what the whole process of craving and desire promises. It's going to give you something which is beautiful and wonderful. But when you get it, so what? It doesn't quite match your expectations. And it leaves you with a hollow feeling afterwards. A feeling you have to want something more to fill the gap. That wanting, that craving, is just like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. we sort of go towards the end of the rainbow and it moves further away from us. And then we go a bit further and it's still just out of arm's reach. The happiness and fulfillment which most people chase in life, they never reach. They can get so close. And that is the promise of craving. That's a delusion. Mara offering you these wonderful gifts. And you can almost catch them, but you just can't. And we feel if we could only try harder, run faster, work more, be more clever, more smart, then maybe we'll be able to catch what we really want in life. But what the Buddha's pointing out here in this Anattalakkhana Sutta, he said, you can't. It's impossible. And that all the things which you crave for, all the things which you desire, all the things which you hope for, are going to lack fulfillment. They're not going to satisfy you. Simply because, whether it's physical things, the rupa, whether it's your pleasure or pain, beauty and ugliness, all the pleasant and unpleasant things connected with the senses, all the perceptions, even your will and your thoughts, and especially your consciousness, doesn't belong to you, it belongs to nature. And it will follow the laws of nature, it will not be bent to your will. And so you should realize from that great teaching that you're just creating more suffering for yourself by not understanding the nature of this world. And you can go through monastic life, lay life, and sometimes we feel that when things go wrong, that it's our fault. We feel guilty, we feel inadequate, that we feel that we failed. When you understand this teaching of anatta, there is no such thing as failure. Who has failed? It's just the working out of the five khandhas according to karma. And it's the same way with blaming others and getting angry at them. How can you get angry at somebody? The only reason why people get angry, either themselves or others, is the frustration of not being able to control their life, not being able to control others. And of course, just talking with someone about their married life today, that's just so common when you have relationships in married life. We want to control the other person, we want to control the relationship. But these things, they're just like trying to control a raging river. It's just totally beyond us. That's why that when we try, we only get ourselves injured. We get tired, we get frustrated. And it's only when we don't understand the nature of things, to understand they are uncontrollable, they are not me, they're not mine, they're not a self. And because of that, we can't bend them to our will. We can't make them just so. When we understand that, it changes the whole way we look at life. And it changes the way we do things and react to things. Whenever we get depressed, upset, fed up, we realize that it's not our fault. It's not the fault of the monastery, it's not the fault of the place, it's not the fault of anybody. This is the nature of things. Life doesn't go the way we want it to, very often. That's its nature, and it's nothing gone wrong. So you don't have to do something to repair the damage. The damage is part of the world. So one makes peace and accepts it and embraces it and deals with it. And when life is going wonderful, you realize it won't last. This is just the ups and downs, the rise and fall of the Vedana in life. What do you expect? And no matter where you go, no matter what you do, whether you're in your heart meditating seriously or whether you're just in your heart sleeping all day, or whether you are diligent, whether you are lazy, no matter with your studying or your walking meditation, you know those Vedanas. Sometimes they're pleasant, sometimes they're unpleasant. And that's the nature of them. So after a while, when one sees that, one accepts this as the nature of life. And when you have sort of not such a good meditation, you don't think, I've done something wrong. How am I supposed to fix this? Now, what was my mistake? You don't think like that. You just look and say, this is the nature of the mind. Sometimes it gets still, sometimes it's not so still. That's its nature. Why? Because the mind doesn't belong to me. It's out of control. It belongs to nature, and I cannot bend it according to my will to be just like this or just like that. And the same with your body, whether you're healthy or sick, you've got lots of energy or not so much energy. What do you expect of this body? There are sometimes when I wake up and I've got heaps of energy, sometimes I'm tired. And sometimes I look back and say, why am I tired? Because of all the work which I had to do. Why am I got lots of energy? Because of the cup of tea which I've just drunk, or something. You can actually see where it comes from. And you realize that this body is not mine. It goes according to nature. And all of the pleasure and the pain of it, I know I cannot control it. I cannot just make it happen. In fact, I know more than that. I know that every time I try and control this body, to try and manipulate so I get the best food, get sort of more sleep, get sort of more warmth, get more cold, I just make it worse. When I fight nature, rather than making peace with nature, I add that extra arrow of suffering, what the Buddha called the mental suffering. Well, I don't want things to be like this. I want things to be different. That tightness of the mind, that struggle against a force which you cannot overpower, fighting a battle which is unwinnable, just makes it much, much worse. So I realize to lessen suffering, which is my job, I just have to let these things be. And to embrace the pleasant and the unpleasant which comes up in my mind, understanding that it cannot be any different. And you also understand that even just the perceptions, the way I look at life, the way I look at life is all to do again with just my upbringing, conditioning and habits. Just those perceptual frameworks of life. These are the ones which can free you or which can imprison you. They're frameworks. Some have got holes through them which you can actually go through and just pass through and escape. And some imprison you. And it's those perceptions, the what we call the wrong view, the micchaditti, which can so imprison people. And I've already mentioned one of those wrong views, thinking that there can be some satisfaction through sensory desire, thinking that one can actually get some real fulfillment from just watching movies, through sex, through possession. You know, sometimes people mistake what true freedom is. That point which I made many times, and sometimes that when you give a talk, the talk can have much, much Dhamma, but people only remember a few sayings. And the major saying here in this talk is to understand the freedom from desire rather than the freedom of desire. I found that's a very good little sound bite which people can remember. The freedom from desire, that's the one which I like the most. That means the freedom from controlling these five khandhas, from controlling my body, other people's body, the world around me, my emotions, my feelings, my thoughts, my perceptions, my will. The freedom from controlling those things, even the freedom from controlling the consciousness and its objects. The freedom from desire. That's called peace of mind. And the freedom of desire. And I've played around with that before. Wanting, manipulating, planning, trying to get what I want. And all that does is it encourages that desire. It makes it stronger and it just burns me even more. I've been a monk long enough to see that now. When I want something, when I crave for it, when I desire it, when I strive and struggle, it's just so much pain. When I just let it go, stop struggling, and I have this beautiful freedom from desire. I realize that just this is the way this the world goes. Sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's hot. Sometimes it rains, sometimes it shines. Sometimes the rain goes through the roof and messes up the bamboo floor. Sometimes I expect this. So you don't get really upset at life when things go wrong. Been a long time as a monk now, I know that life is what goes wrong. You don't get upset when people just die suddenly, when they're young and they just keel over in front of you like that man did the other day. Oh, he's only about, how old was he? 52, I think he was. Just talking to you and then having short of breath and then falling over. You know, I expect that to happen. I've seen it before. It's normal. I know that some people thought that that was, what do you mean it's normal? That's a terrible thing. Someone died and some people just got very anxious about this. But it's just life. It's just what happens. And when you learn how to accept life, realizing it is uncontrollable, you understand what life what life can give you and what it can't, and you accept this, then you have this beautiful freedom from desires. You're not struggling to make this world any difference. You're making peace with it, accepting it. Other people in the world may struggle, become politicians, become soldiers, become bankers, and try and change the world. But the job of a monk is not to change the world, but to make peace with the world. I always remember that wonderful metaphor, which was part of the story of the Buddha, where before he became enlightened, Mara came up to the Buddha and said that you could be this amazing, powerful emperor. You can change the whole world and bring peace, prosperity, and happiness to the whole world by being a world-turning monarch. And the Buddha said, I know you, Mara. Get out of here. And you can see just this is what we want to do. We want to do something good for the world, be a world-turning father, mother, sort of boss of a company, be a world-turning abbot of a monastery, influencing everybody and making the world a better place. And that is a temptation of Mara, to think that you can actually make this world different than its nature. Many people have tried that, and many people have just made the world worse. The job of a monk is not to change the world. The job of a monk is to understand the world and make peace with it. I remember that, I'm just rambling now, that great story of Ajahn Mahabua when I was with him. And he told me this story from his youth. And it was when he had malaria. And when he had malaria, Ajahn Mahabua, being the tough guy, still a bit of a tough guy, he decided to fight the malaria. And so even though he had malaria and a fever, when it came time for the chores, he got up from his bed. Even though he was shaking and weak from the fever, he got the broom and started sweeping. And of course, we'd never ask anyone to do that. If any of you are sick, you don't ask you to do your work, do your jobs. But he decided just to do that. And instead of Ajahn Mun, his teacher, instead of Ajahn Mun praising him for just how tough and strong he was, how he wasn't going to give in to the painful and tiring physical feelings, Ajahn Mun just blasted him as a stupid monk. He said, your job as a Buddhist is not to fight the sickness, but to understand it, to contemplate it. That's all. And this is the job of a monk, not to fight the fever of the world, not to try and change things, because that, according to Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, is impossible and stupid. You're only going to make things worse. You're going to create more problems for yourself and others. Your job is to understand things, not to fight them. And if you can understand things, understand the feelings, understand the will, understand consciousness, understand just the experiences of your life. You know, that you feel down, you feel up. You feel tired, you feel energetic. You go through the seasons of the cold and the hot and the wet and the dry. You go through the seasons of your day. Sometimes you wake up, you're having a wonderful time, beautiful mind. The next time, it's just all over the place. Don't think, my mind is beautiful and peaceful. This is it. This is what I'm really like. And when sort of things go pear-shaped, to think, I've made a mistake, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible. Remember, that is misunderstanding the Dhamma. That's not the right framework. Your job is just to understand that these are the seasons of the mind. This is just the play of happiness and pain. This is just life coming and going. and it's totally out of your control. You're just like the passenger in the bus looking through the window. You see, you experience, you hear, you feel, but you know you're not the driver. If you could only see that you were not the driver, you stop all this complaining and fidgeting and worrying. You learn from these things rather than trying to fight them, as Ajahn Mahabua tried to do. And so Ajahn Mun sort of taught him that Dhamma. Go back to your heart, lay down and contemplate. Be with the fever rather than trying to control it. And understand that this is just fever, not me, not mine, not a self. If it was under my power, I could do something about it, but I can't. I just have to make peace with it. Be kind, be gentle, let it go. And that Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, understanding that all these things, we're not supposed to fight them, we're supposed to understand with them, embrace them, be with them. I know you, Mara, the saying goes. And as soon as you recognize the truth of Mara, then Mara vanishes. Mara, supposed to be the head of the Paranimitta Vasavati Devaloka, the Paranimitta Vasavati, the gods who wield power over other people's creations. Now you can understand what that is. What wields power over your creations? You can see it's that will, that controller inside of you. That's the Mara inside, the controller, wields power. He said, once you know that, I know you will, I know you controller, I know you struggler, striver, agitator. Once you can understand not just what you're experiencing, but how you're experiencing it, and the way we want to sort of control, manipulate and manage our world, thinking that by such control and managing and will, we can make things better, like the wheel-turning emperor of our life. When you actually see that, that is Mara right there. Every time when you sit here and you want the talk to end early, every time when you're sort of sitting down and you want to move, every time when you're sitting in your heart and you want a cup of tea, or you're standing up and you want to sit down, you're sitting up, you want to walk, you're walking, you want to lay down, all those times when you're trying to control and make this world a better place for yourself, Mara, the controller. See that. If you can only see that, you know Mara, then Mara will have no more power over you. Instead of trying to sort of manipulate and struggle and strive and drive this vehicle called your life, you'll make peace with it. Yeah, sometimes you're sick, sometimes you're healthy. That's the nature of this life. Just the rise and fall of happiness and suffering, pleasure and pain, totally out of control. So you let it go, you make peace with it, you're kind to it. And then an amazing thing happens. When you don't fight the world, then the world becomes more peaceful. You realize that by following this path of Dhamma, instead of following the path of the world, where you sort of struggle and strive and control and make things happen, where you enhance your will and strengthen the will. And I just notice these days, this is just a little theory, but I think there's some truth in it. Because the world is a tougher place to live, you need to strive and struggle more to live up to people's expectations, because the expectations have risen. The amount of money, property, which you're supposed to have to be successful in this world. The stakes have risen so high that people have to struggle so hard. They actually encourage and strengthen their will. And all these motivational psychologists, you know, the guys from the United States in sharp suits and slick hairdos, like Anthony Robbins or something, those sorts of people, what do? They just say, well, if you're smart enough and if you train your will and strengthen your will, you can achieve everything you want in life. Just have a strong will and be smart. Or like that book, The Secret. Just as long as you can imagine, and then you'll get whatever you want in life. Now you can see those sorts of ideas, they are extremes of what most people do in this world. Extreme examples of a trend when people struggle and strive. And what happens to people in this world? They get frustrated and angry. And from that frustration, all that frustration is they're realizing their will is not powerful enough to create happiness and peace and success. Will is not good enough. And so what do? They try harder. And they get more frustrated. And the harder you will, the more you strengthen the will, the more angry you get. All anger is coming when the will gets so strong and it meets the brick wall. When the force of anger meets the brick wall of nature, which won't allow it to control it, you get this terrible anger. Why are you so stupid? Why is the world so stupid? I can never forget this one time at Wat Nanachat, when one of the monks was sewing his robe, and because he was not a skillful sewer, the needle kept breaking. And I think it's about the third time it broke, and I saw him banging the sewing machine against the wall. You stupid sewing machine, you stupid sewing machine. He got angry at the sewing machine. Now you all know the sewing machine has not got consciousness. It's not sort of doing this on purpose. It's just a sewing machine. It follows cause and effect. That's all. Just like other people in this monastery. We're all like sewing machines. It's just, you know, just a bit more complicated mechanisms. That's all. And so just taking somebody you don't like and banging against the wall, you stupid anagarika, you stupid monk, whatever. Just I'm being a monk. I'm just an anagarika. What do you expect? So you can see where anger comes from. It's just thinking you can control and get it just the way it should be, whatever should be happens to be. And usually after that anger, you usually get so tired because it takes up so much energy getting angry. You end up being depressed. And to me, the epidemic of depression in our modern world very much comes from how much controlling and how much will people generate inside their lives. The more controlling, the more will they generate, the more likely it is they're going to end up via frustration and anger into depression. That's not a way to go. So instead of that, you know, we let go of this maya, this control. We understand whether it's bodies, forms, things, whether it's iPods or whether it's CD players, whether it's computers, whether it's cars, they're going to go wrong. Actually, they don't go wrong, they go right. They don't work, that's right. That they don't work every now and again, that they crash, that's right. It's not something that's gone wrong with the internet. This is right that this happens, it's nature it happens. And whether it's our feelings, that sometimes we're upset, sometimes we're happy, as Ajahn Chah always used to teach, don't follow those moods. Just understand that, yeah, they'll pass by themselves. Now you're having a good time, now you're depressed, then get a good time again, now I'll be happy, now I'll be sad. That's the nature of life. Expect that. Understand that that has to be the way. And if you think that it's going to be happy, 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 happy all the time, just like sort of those in Hollywood, the seven dwarfs. You go up to the kitchen to make the breakfast tomorrow morning. Hi ho, hi ho, it's off to work we go. I'm making breakfast for the monks. Hi ho, hi ho, hi ho, hi. Now that's Hollywood. I mean, it doesn't happen like that way. It usually is, oh God, I've got to get up in the morning to make breakfast for these fat monks. What do I have to do this for? Can't they make their own breakfast? They're old enough to do this. Why do I have to do this? And sometimes you feel like that. And accept that. That's going to happen because just sometimes you feel down, sometimes you feel happy. So accept this because you understand this is just feelings. It's Vedana. It's just perceptions. It's not me. It's not mine, not a self. So this is actually where you understand these things and you detach from them. They're just feelings and thoughts. When you detach from them, it means you stop controlling them. You stop thinking there's something wrong. You stop feeling there's something I must do about this to make it better. You just watch them, you understand them, like Ajahn Mun told Ajahn Mahabodhi to do. You just contemplate them. My body feels just like a shithole. I'm just tired, sick, feel awful. You contemplate this. You think, this is acceptable. This is having a human body. This is what it's like. Or you get sick with cancer and you're about to die. What do you expect? Most of us are going to get cancer. At least many of us will. So this is what we can expect in life. If we don't get cancer, we'll have heart disease. Not heart disease, we get swine flu or some other terrible thing. And if you're really lucky, that's why I go on aircraft a lot. I'm hoping that don't get cancer, get blown up 30,000 feet. Whatever happens, you're going to sort of cop it eventually. So this is actually where we understand this is the nature of things. We accept this. We don't try and escape from it. We contemplate it. We contemplate there's nothing gone wrong. This is not the fault of life. This is the nature of life. And so our response becomes is taking away the mental arrow of not wanting, taking away the mental arrow of craving, taking away the mental arrow of controlling and manipulating. Instead, we just embrace and let things be. It was lots of contemplation like that which made the way I teach meditation. What do? You just sit there and you watch. You don't control. You don't say, oh, may my mind just watch the breath and nothing else. If your mind did belong to you, if your breath did belong to you, you could achieve that. I just said this in the words of the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. You know, the breath is supposed to be part of the body, it's part of rupa. Oh, may my rupa be like this, may my rupa be like that. Oh, may my breath be like this, may my breath be like this. The Buddha said the breath doesn't belong to you, therefore you just can't do that. You're just going to weary yourself and trouble yourself. So instead of doing that, one just lets the breath be. Long breath, short breath, dull breath, energized breath, leave it alone. Let it go. Stop controlling it. Pleasure and pain which come up, you're sort of having a difficult time, you've got aches here and pain there, dullness or sleepiness. And I was always taught to fight sleepiness when I was young. What a stupid teaching that was. It took me a lot of guts, a lot of courage to realize, no, you don't fight sleepiness. You contemplate it, you make peace with it, you let it be. Why? Because sleepiness doesn't belong to me. It's not me, not mine, not a self. If it was me, mine, or self, I would be able to control it. I'd be able to say, okay, sleepiness, get out of here. I'm going to be bright and alert and get into jhana now. It doesn't belong to you. It's not yours. It's just nature. So when sleepiness comes, what should you do? If sloth and torpor are there, take away the mental arrow of controlling. I don't want to be sleepy. I don't want to be tired. I don't want to feel like this. That is a mental arrow. That's what you can do something about. It's actually a not doing. It's a not controlling. So renouncing, a letting go, detaching, abandoning, relinquishing. Relinquishing your control. Just say sleepy. I'm just going to observe this, contemplate it. My whole job is to make sure I'm not going to interfere and just get upset or control. That's my whole job, to observe and to guard me from interfering. That's just like the old simile of growing a tree. Your job as a gardener, it's all planted, is to stop people interfering. Stop the kangaroos from eating it. Stop those stupid sheep at Jhana Grove from nibbling the plants. That's all you need to do to protect the stupid defilements from nibbling the jhana plant which is already planted inside of you. Your job is to protect. The plants grow by themselves. Your job is just to make sure that nothing interferes and meditation just grows by itself. Jhanas happen. I think that's one of the reasons why the jhana practice was so important for understanding Dhamma. The most wonderful thing which happens when you do nothing. It's just like a big neon sign in front of your eyes. Look stupid. This is the way to peace and freedom. by stopping controlling and manipulating and agitating the mind. Look stupid when you do nothing, when you really just contemplate, you're just there, you're not controlling, you're not managing. All this amazing, wonderful peace and stillness and profundity and bliss better than sex all just happens. See, stupid? That's sometimes what it's like. It's just like this great teacher there, sort of hitting you with what should be obvious. That sometimes that we are stupid. We think that, yeah, we can control, try a bit harder, work a bit more, and then you get all these amazing things. Your job is not to do that. It's not to be another Mara, or a Paranimitta Wasawati monk, sort of wielding control over other people's, in other words, the world's creations. It's nature's creations. You shouldn't wield power over it. You should just contemplate it and see what happens. Why? Because it doesn't belong to me, not mine, not a self. And of course, you know, that's one of my lovely little mantras, if you call it a mantra, just this way of looking at meditation. Whenever I'm experiencing, none of my business. Oh, you know, I'm a very busy monk, I've got so much stuff to do, it's great when I meditate. Yeah, I've got to still look after the retreat centre, still the committee meetings and the Buddhist society, and every now and again somebody calls from overseas, and you get all this stuff to do. But when I meditate, it's brilliant. None of my business. So I don't make my meditation another chore which I have to make sure I do well. No, this is meditation, it's something completely of a different caliber. Meditation where I just sit there and watch. Whatever happens, none of my business. Jhana, none of my business. Sleepiness, none of my business. It's not me, not mine, not a self. And amazing things happen when you have that attitude. Because it's a perception according to Dhamma, according to the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, whether it's rupa, bodies, doesn't belong to me, I can't control it. And those of you who try and control a girl, if you want to sort of have a girlfriend, who try and control a boy, if you want a boyfriend, hey, just come and sit next to me when all these people tell me what marriage is really like. And then you find you just can't control them. All these, even today, poor old Simon. So I'm trying to sort of change my wife. Oh, come on, you should know better than that. You just can't do that. She's trying to change you. A complete pain and suffering. And you just can't control people. And they just go their own way. They blow up. And when you, the thing is, when you try and control them, that's when you make it so much worse. And so when you see these things, you don't try and control Rupa, you don't control Vedana, you have good moments and not so good moments. That is par for the course. It's always going to be like that. When you're out there in the world, in a monastery, when you're, as I say, the dog with mange, when you're under a tree, when you're under a rock, when you're in the river, when you're out in the open, no matter where you go, whether you go to a, and I've been to these places, these five-star resorts. It doesn't matter if you're in a five-star resort, and was it Sheraton Beach Resort in Hua Hin, or whether you're in a monastery, it's just the same. Just food is just food. Just the room is just a room. Just close your eyes, you can be in a cave, you can be in a sort of a suite, it doesn't really matter. What is all this stuff anyway? So you find out just all this pleasure and pain, no matter where you are. I remember once going, when I was in this, going to the Japan for this Buddhist summit, and they put me into this big suite, and really sort of a big sort of hotel suite, because it was one of their disciples and I was the leader of the Australian delegation, so they gave me this incredibly big room. And it felt like a, really, it felt like a prison for me, because I couldn't go out, because nowhere to go to, you know, and I couldn't sort of, you know, couldn't turn on the TV, couldn't go in the jacuzzi. You know, I don't know if I even slept on the bed at that time. I just slept on the floor. And I thought, just what I really want is a nice forest to walk in or something instead of this artificial luxury suite. And to me at that time, I realized it was actually a wonderful little recollection. I thought, here am I, sort of sitting in a place which many of my disciples would never be able to afford to go to. And it's pain, it's suffering. And every now and again, when I remember my cave, and there's a place where most of my disciples would think it's torture, and it's the most happiest place for me. What is a prison? What is freedom? You all know that. Prison doesn't matter where you are, whether you're in a ritzy suite in a big hotel, or whether you're in just a cave on the floor. It's whether you want to be there or not, whether you're content. If you want to be somewhere else, it's called prison. It's a nice little simple way of looking at things. Wanting to be somewhere else, wanting to change the world, wanting to control the five khandhas, you put yourself in prison. It's not the freedom at all. The freedom of desires is no freedom at all. The more desires you have, the more you put yourself in prison. You have no freedom, no satisfaction, no peace. You just end up getting angry and getting depressed. Why? Because that's where desires lead you. When you understand the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, it's none of my business. I'm not going to fight the world anymore. I'm going to make peace with it. Be kind to it. Be gentle with it. Just let it be. You find the whole attitude changes. Instead of feeling like life is a prison, you always want to go somewhere else to find some freedom, to find some peace, to find some happiness. The pot of gold is no longer at the end of the rainbow. You're not chasing anything anymore. You're not having to go anywhere or do anything or be anybody. This whole pressure on you to actually to achieve, to go, to get. This whole irritation which keeps that mangy dog on the move. You're taking it away. At last you can be still. You stood your ground against Mara. You just sit here, tired, restless, aching, miserable. Doesn't matter, this is good enough for me. None of my business. I'm going to make peace with this. And that is where the Dhamma begins. That's where the practice starts. When you make peace with things. When you're content with even just what some people think is impossible to be content with. I found in my practice you can be content with anything, even with severe pain, or even with those experiences which I've told you about in my early years, typhus fever. You can be content with that. And that was amazing, just I mean, really wiped out big time, can't even walk except by grabbing onto the bed next to you and holding yourself up. It's amazing just what the mind can do, because you're not fighting anymore. You're not controlling, you're just being, contemplating, letting things be. That's where the practice begins. And what happens next, I've mentioned it to you many, many times, when you just let this moment be, when you stop fighting, controlling, when you don't want to be anywhere else, you're just happy to be right here. You're not fighting the five khandhas, you're not trying to say, oh, may it be different, oh, may it be like this, oh, may my perception just be on the breath, oh, may I see animitta, oh, my experience jhanas, all that sort of rubbish is not practice. The practice, like Ajahn Mun said, just being here and contemplating, not fighting. And you do that, and wow, body relaxes, mind relaxes, because you're not fighting, you're not stressing out against life. Body becomes easy, the mind becomes free, the breath, it just comes to you. Beautiful breath, just there. Nimittas, brilliant, beautiful, just incredible. Where the heck did that come from? I never asked for that. I never did it at all, exactly. Because you didn't expect it, you didn't want it, you didn't ask for it, you didn't try and get it, you didn't try and control it. It's because of all of your letting be, all of the letting go, all of the Dharma practice, the practice, the practice, the practice of letting go of control. That's where it all comes from. You're sitting there and you think, ah, now I understand the path of a Buddha. This is the middle way, this is the Eightfold Path. This is the reason why when the Buddha taught the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, these five monks became arahats. Full-on saints, free, liberated, forever. Because they let go. They just were there, watching. And this whole process just happened. when they weren't doing anything about it. It's a process of letting go. It's like turning off the switch. Turning off the switch of desire, the controller, the craver. You turn it off, and instead of getting dark, like you turn on the switches of, say, the hall here, everything gets brilliant, brighter than a billion suns. The mind is still, peaceful, and with those beautiful nimittas, incredible peace and happiness and bliss beyond your wildest dreams, literally. It's not just some sort of slogan from a sort of a dodgy car dealer. This is real, true bliss, better than you can ever expect, just there for you. Into the jhanas, and amazing, profound states which blow your mind, literally blow it up into smithereens until it just vanishes. All this incredible stuff. And it just happens when you get out of the way. And all these great insights which you read about in the suttas. All this experience. Why is it that in the suttas these people become arahats, stream winners, all over the place? You know, just street sweepers, prostitutes. You know, let alone you guys. You know, you've got far smarter than these street sweepers. You've heard much more dharma than those guys. You're far healthier, far fatter than those guys. So why can't you do it? Because just that little trick, that little switch, that one thing of seeing things in a different way, stopping controlling, letting go, abandoning craving, making peace, being kind, being gentle, renouncing nekama. It's renouncing what? It's renouncing this thing inside of you which controls, manages, manipulates. And how do you renounce that? Just check out that Anatta Lakkhana Sutta again. Rupa, forms, material things. If it was mine, said the Buddha, I'd be able to control it this way and that way. But it cannot be done, because it doesn't belong to you. So just stop controlling it. Your pleasure and pain, joy and misery, that doesn't belong to you either. Stop attaching to your moods, to your happiness and pleasure and pain and suffering. Stop attaching. It doesn't belong to you. It's just life, that's all. So stop controlling it. Let it go. Renounce it. Renounce pleasure, renounce pain. Or rather, renounce trying to control it. Your job is just to observe, to contemplate. That's all. Not to control. And all your perceptions, stop trying to control them. Stop trying to make it sort of wiser or smarter. Just perceptions, that's all. Stop them from being controlled by you. Trying to control your perceptions like trying to control a wife. She'll just turn and hit you back. And thinking the same. Let's try to control a husband. They'll just come and hit you back as well. Thoughts are just thoughts. Leave them alone. Don't try and start them. Don't try and stop them. Just watch them. They're not me, not mine, not my business. So all these amazing thoughts which lead people around by the nose, they're just, you're free of them. Yeah, the thought's there. Nothing to do with me. Just something I have to deal with. But it's a thought, that's all. Not real, not true. I don't give them any importance at all. My thoughts are not wise. It's just the way you look at the thoughts is where wisdom is. Not in the thoughts. So the thoughts are just so much sort of babble coming through the mind. And will, I'm not going to try and make my will smarter. I'm not going to control my will. That's what a lot of people do. They try and, okay, I'm supposed to let go of my will. That's more willing. Or I'm supposed to be smarter. That's more willing. Just leave the whole thing alone. Just watch this whole process of Chaitanya. And just disassociate yourself with it. None of my business. And then just the will stops. And consciousness itself, the experience of life, none of my business. Even experience doesn't belong to me. So I can even let that go too. And if you understand the meaning of that, of letting go of consciousness, you understand why nibbana is cessation. If you truly let something go, you don't control it. none of your business. It moves out and never comes back. You're not interested in it, and it's not interested in you. That's where consciousness fades, disappears. Why? Nothing to do with me. If you can't do that now, how the heck do you think you're going to do that when you die? How can you let go of consciousness and enter parinibbana? If you think consciousness is your business, then when you die, you're going to continue being conscious in one world or another. Keep getting reborn and go through the same old mess all over again. I often said, have you had enough with nappies and going to primary school and secondary school? Have you had enough yet of getting old and sick and dying? Go and look at somebody who's dying. Go to those funerals and yeah, you're going to cop that once for sure, but how many times do you want to do that? The old age and sickness business. And don't think that if you're smart you can avoid these terrible cancers. These painful endings to life. I notice sometimes people say, oh, with palliative care you get the silver chain and they can shoot you up with this and shoot you up with that and you don't feel pain. That is just so much rubbish. I don't know how many times I've seen people. I remember old Don Clark, who told me, literally in front of me, said, can't you please take me out the back and shoot me? And he was in hospital with the best care and just struggling the last few days. Every breath was a struggle. No sleep. Just struggle, because he couldn't let go enough just to let the breath go out and not let it go in again. It's painful. Do you want to do that again? Just once is enough. And the one which is in front of you later on in your life. How can you do that? By learning how to renounce consciousness. Not me, not mine. Renounce your will. Renounce all this stuff which causes you a lot of problems. And you can practice that whenever you sit down, cross your legs, or sit on a chair. Let go of the controller. Walking meditation, just walk backwards and forwards. You're not going anywhere. You're not trying to achieve anything. Let go. Your job is just to observe, to watch. Don't get involved in the thoughts. Just watch them. Let them go. Don't try and stop them. Don't try and start them. Just detach from them. They're just thoughts, just like the birds. Like the kangaroos, you don't try and grab them by the tail and tie them to your hut. They just go past and they disappear. If you feed them, they stay. If you don't feed the thoughts, they vanish. And that way you're practicing. You're practicing renouncing, controlling the world. You're letting go of desire, abandoning craving. That's what we're supposed to be renouncing. It's not so much renouncing our material possessions and renouncing this. Renouncing this controlling business. That's what we should renounce. And that's why the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta tells us why we should do that. Those monks who understood that, those first five monks, they understood what's there to control anymore. Everything, these five khandhas, totally encompassing every phenomena. None of it you can control, inner or outer. So you stop. There's nothing left which is in your power to do anything. So you abandon all power. You have nibbida, this relinquishment of everything. Can't control it, it's not my business, I don't even want to contemplate it. Just throw it away. Things vanish and disappear. Then you're free, vimutti. And you know you're free. You know there's no more birth for you. This is your last life. This is the reason why you're a monk, why you're a novice, why you're a layperson coming to a monastery practicing. To make an end of rebirth once and for all. Otherwise, just come back again and again and again. Haven't you had enough yet? So contemplate the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. It's one of the most brilliant teachings ever in samsara. is probably even more important, more powerful than the Dhammacakka Sutta. That's why it's one of my favourites, if not the most favourite one. It's what just totally kicks wrong view out of the ballpark. So you just have right view. Everything, all the five khandhas, body, material things, pleasure and pain, perceptions, thoughts and will, consciousness itself, none of my business, uncontrollable, belongs to nature if I just let it go and become enlightened. That's the teaching on non-self. So, how many of you got arahat?
Arahant Sangha Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivade Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sangha.